Real College Podcast is presented by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and is a production of Radio K.
You're listening to Real College Podcast, and I'm your host, Alex Schumacher. With the start of the school year here at the University of Minnesota, we're taking stock at the summer behind us and looking forward to the fall in front of us. In this episode of Real College Podcast, we're looking both backwards and forwards at cool cultural events in the area, music, movies, and more here on Real College Podcast. If you listened to the last episode of the podcast, then you know that this summer we made a big effort to send reporters out to music festivals. Last week we aired Nathan's pieces, and now, this week we're airing Liv and Ben's piece. They went to the Eau Claire Music Festival, and so, without further ado, let's find out what they thought.
This past summer, the Real College Podcast sent two correspondents, Ben Hallam and Liv Riggins, to the Eau Claire Music Festival in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And what we found surprised us in some ways, as it was intended to. The festival didn't announce the lineup until the day it began, a move which many viewed as a publicity stunt, but which the festival insisted was part of the experience. The organizers of the festival described it on their website as something that was never meant to be fully understood or easily delineated. To be honest, I think that's a little pretentious. It's not really that hard to understand what a music festival is. And pretending otherwise only makes you seem like you're covering up for something. So, Liv and I did our best to fully understand and easily delineate the nature of the festival by speaking to attendees and sharing our own experiences.
So I'm lucky enough to be able to volunteer with people that print all the merchandise. So thankful to be here, period, first year. I know maybe a couple of the artists, and if I know the artists, it's maybe a couple songs. So most of it is new to me. Supposedly the capacity or whatever, the amount of people that are here has been cut down over the years, which is awesome. I mean, I wasn't here before, but it seems like just the right amount of people, and working at the merch booth has been fun. Got plenty of time to just talk to people, and it seems like, yeah, people coming from all over. You get stuck in like the thought of Wisconsin and like, oh, everyone's local now. Still have a lot to discover. I haven't checked everything out yet, but definitely be back, probably because of the volunteering thing. But in general, I didn't really come in with many expectations. So.
Something that surprised both Liv and I when we began conducting interviews was just how devoted some attendees were to the idea of the music festival and to the concepts behind it. It seemed like no matter what happened, no matter what music was playing, they were going to love the festival.
So what brought you to Eau Claire this year, not knowing the lineup but not knowing who was going to be playing at the festival?
I came with a group of my friends that have actually been coming since year one, and this is like their religion. They love Eau Claire, and I just knew I couldn't miss out on seeing what it was all about.
Yeah, and so what are you looking forward to this year?
That's a really good question. I'm really looking forward to some of the people that I'm hoping to be able to meet over the next day and a half coming up and just meet some people from different places and make new connections.
Not having known the lineup or anything, why did you choose to come here?
I came 2 years ago, I think. It was a really cool experience. I love all the art installations, especially in the woods, the whole setup. So I kind of trusted that it would be as great as it was last time. I saw like the glowing balloons and stuff like that, but I don't know. I'm sure there's more that I've missed.
This opportunity for surprise is what the festival's planners were hoping for. And it does sound like it created some great experiences for attendees.
Yesterday, like a little bit before sunset, this band Hand Habits was doing a set on the house that's musical, and they had this guy featured who's playing saxophone, and the sun was going down, and I was just like, I'd had like a beer, and it was great, and it was just the most peaceful day of the last 5 years of my life. It was amazing.
For devoted fans of Bon Iver and Eau Claire Festival regulars, it seems to have been almost the perfect festival, a great opportunity to get together with friends and see and hear the music you love in a beautiful outdoor environment.
This is my fourth year, and after the first year, The experience was so cool coming with my friends. I'm from Chicago and we drove all the way up. We kind of just said to each other, it doesn't really matter what happens from here on. We experienced something really cool because of this place, because of each other. We were like, we're just going to come back every year and do this again. And we've done it. This is our fourth year. We've had fun every year. Everything's been really cool in different ways every year. And I think that this year is just a different experience. But I think being able to be super close to these bands that maybe I've seen, maybe I haven't seen, but that are influential to me, be like 5 feet away and kind of experience it in a new way, that's really cool. So I'm excited to see the National there. I'm excited to see Phil Cook play in a little bit, people that I really enjoy and am inspired by. It's a lot of fun.
For some of these devotees, the decision not to announce the lineup and the philosophy behind it actually contributed to their enjoyment of the festival.
I think I believe in the idea of it is what you make it. So coming with my friends, seeing music that I like, being surprised, it's all part of the experience, and I think that's really cool.
It's not my first festival, and I also appreciate time with friends and time spent in the sun. That's what I look forward to every year. So it doesn't matter what the lineup is, because by this point we trust that it'll be a good festival.
Eau Claire fans seem to have no problem buying tickets that could run above $200 just to get in, several hundred more dollars for camping, and just to hang out with friends and enjoy the sunlight, with the music more in the background than the forefront.
It was really cool to have in question who would show up. I feel really comfortable with everything. Day one was such a blast. Today feels really casual and just like relaxed family environment.
Many attendees expressed similar sentiments, focusing on the environment or the relaxation or how it was a chill or more relaxed festival.
For a lot of the people we spoke to at Eau Claire, it seemed like the festival was almost as much about what it didn't have as what it did have. It doesn't have the kind of crowds, all the big stages, and partying that other festivals have. A lot of the hardcore fans of Eau Claire's like it because it's laid back and it kind of feels like maybe the coolest county fair you've ever been to.
I keep coming back because it's a really cool festival. People aren't messy and like it's not muddy and everyone's just like having a good time and they're all very mellow. It's a good festival. It's not like Bonnaroo or Boston Calling or Lollapalooza or just anything crazy.
But for some attendees, and I'll be honest, Liv and I are included in this group, the experience, without a headliner, without any major touring acts beyond Bon Iver and his circle of collaborators, wasn't really enough to sell the festival, especially with the hefty price tag attached to tickets.
My girlfriend's from Eau Claire, so it's my first time here.
All right, thank you. And are you looking forward to anything this year?
I wasn't able to look forward to anything because the lineup wasn't posted until this afternoon, low, I guess, than the National.
Well, not knowing the lineup in particular was a little different from what I'm used to, but I'm just wondering if actual expectations were met from previous year's patrons.
And if you're someone who came mainly for the music, it could be a bit of a letdown compared to other years, which had Erykah Badu, Chance the Rapper, Paul Simon, and John Prine. Some of the main stages sat empty during the day, and it seemed like there wasn't as much music scheduled as there had been in previous years. While big groups like the Russian band Pussy Riot, Marijuana Death Squad, Serengeti, rising hip-hop star No Name, Horror and the National played. Can you remind me of the building you live in? They were pretty much the outliers in a schedule that consisted mainly people that Bon Iver has worked with jamming together. It was very much like a band camp kind of atmosphere. It was a whole lot of fun to be out there on a sunny 80-degree day, everyone listening to these bands and just hanging out.
I feel like I was just confident that the festival would pick people I would enjoy hearing, and then I knew I'd have fun with my friends who were here.
I love how you have to walk through a forest to get to music. The trees dance into the music.
Documentary. This is my fourth year here, and it's always a great time. That's why we always come back. You know, it's like family, right?
Coming to you from the Eau Claire's Music Festival, or as it's known on the t-shirts sold there, the Eau Claire's Family Reunion, it's Liv Riggins and Ben Hallam for Radio K's Real College Podcast.
While the Eau Claire Music Festival already happened this year, I wanted to include a cultural event that people here in the Twin Cities could take part in the months to come. I ended up reaching out to the Trilon Cinema, a single-screen repertory theater that shows old films and hosts film series across the year. I ended up talking with John Moret, the film programmer at the Trilon, to learn more.
When you're projecting a 35mm film reel-to-reel like we do here, we have two projectors. And when you see that little cigarette burn on the right-hand corner, you're having the projectionist is behind you, and that projectionist is waiting and getting just the right time and starting up, and then they're framing it and they're focusing, and there's a workman behind you working on something. And at the same time, you're also seeing every time that film plays, it's degrading. It's dying in front of you. So in that way, you're seeing this print in a way that no one else has ever seen it before or after. And that is different about digital too, because digital is always the same. It'll always be presented the same, it'll never change. Eventually the digital files will degrade and they'll have to make a new hard drive, but the actual presentation of the film will always be the same. And I think there's something very special to me about the human nature of 35mm. It's almost like cinema is this last space that's a sanctuary from the digital. My name is John Moret. I'm the film programmer at the Trilon Cinema. It's my job to sift through ideas of my own and others, choose the films we want to show, and then hunt down rights owners, rare prints. The hunt for 35mm film has kind of become my obsession, where I'm talking to small film collectors all over the country. I'm working with archives, I'm working with libraries, I'm kind of in this place where I've done my very best to get myself into that community so that I'll know when something pops up or when something starts finding its legs a little bit. There's a film earlier in the summer we did called The Spook Who Sat by the Door.
The Spook Who Sat by the Door, the controversial best-selling novel, now becomes a shocking screen reality.
And I'd wanted to do it forever, and one of these collectors on the East Coast said, oh, I found this new print, and it's a little brown, but it's, you know, it's totally playable. And so I jumped on it and immediately found a way to work it into a series. So that happens too, where you kind of are sitting on something and then you're like, oh, it's there, let's do it right away. And other times it's like, I want to play that in 3 years from now, maybe I'll get to play that. Part of the problem and part of the benefit of where I am now is almost all films are available in some format. For a while there was kind of a scarcity, if you couldn't find a print, you couldn't show something. Where now there's usually DCPs of some kind somewhere. The larger problem we run into now is I'm really in love with 35mm film, and it's dying, and it's going away. And so as I find great films, especially from the 1970s or before, film seems appropriate. And what's left of it, they're not making new prints. The prints are getting played until they're no longer playable. So we run into things pretty regularly where there's no way to show it except digitally. So that ends up changing what I'm showing. When our executive director, Barry Krishka, was coming up with the idea for the Trilon Micro Cinema, he was looking at the idea of the screening room, which was a thing that they used to do for critics. They had tiny little screening rooms inside larger movie theaters. They would kind of carve out a space. And then they would make those spaces open for critics to see movies before they came out. And he was able to go to a few of those screenings and kind of loved that little space and the intimacy of a 25 to a 50 seat cinema. I think what the AMCs and the Alamo Draft Houses and all the really big movie theaters are out there, what they do really, really well is present huge cinemas with lots of big sound for huge films. You know, if you go see the new Mission Impossible movie or the Fast and the Furious movie, that is a great experience in that giant cinema.
And I think it provides a huge audience. You can be in a huge room with tons of people to watch Star Wars. And that's very exciting on its own way. I remember that experience when I was 9, you know, watching, I think, Indiana Jones or something. You know, and it's so it has a place. But I think that small cinemas have an intimacy where you're allowed to take chances. And I think what Hollywood is not doing anymore, and what these large cinemas don't do, is take chances on small films or films that may have a chance to find an audience, but probably not. Films now in these giant places are made with an international market in mind, you know, especially China. So they cut down on the dialogue and they simplify storylines. And what, especially what we do at the Tron is, because we're repertory, we're only showing older films. We don't show anything made in the last, I try not to show anything in the last 10 years. By doing that, we provide a different sense of history of cinema, but also of viewing the world. So I saw this film called The Great Silence about 2 years ago on a bootleg VHS tape that I found. And the way that I tend to work around programming is I find a film I really love, and then I find a way to make it work and decide how I'm going to build around it. So one way I could have gone with it was to choose the lead actor and, you know, do a film about him, or and then a series about him, 4 or 5 films. Another way would be to do the director that Sergio Corbucci, he did Django, he did some other films. I could have kind of done a Corbucci series. But at the time, there was no way to show the film. There was a print in Italy. We couldn't afford to bring it in, and it was also damaged. So I was kind of in a spot where I was like, I love this film. Do think spaghetti westerns as a whole could do really well. So I was trying to form this series around it, and I kind of just had to wait, because I knew that there would be at some point somebody's either going to bring the print over from Italy and it'll, you know, be repaired and it'll show at the, you know, film forum in New York or something, and then we can jump on board and pay to ship it from New York to here, or wait for a new restoration. And as it happened, Film Movement did a restoration of it this last spring. So I sort of like jumped on the idea and then did what I could. It can be a really long process.
Like, do you have to play the long game? Like,
oh, definitely. My friends always make fun of me that I'm always, they're like, what about this idea? And I'm always like, I've got a plan 5 years from now. I'm doing, you know, I know what I kind of have it mapped out. In my mind, I have the next 2 years mapped out. But that will definitely change as things either become available or unavailable. One series I'm extremely, extremely excited about is we're doing just 2 films from this Japanese director named Hirokazu Koreeda. His films are astonishing. They're these kind of small, intimate, quiet films that are super, super thoughtful, and they just they don't really get shown or seen, I think, because there's nothing in them that's super exciting. There's nothing in them that's really gonna draw in an audience that's looking for something like horror, or it's none of that. They're kind of mostly family dramas. The two we're showing are 2 really early ones. One is called Afterlife. It takes place in kind of this school that works as a purgatory. So when people die, they go to this school and they meet with a guidance counselor who is like, you get 1 week to pick the one memory you can bring with you to the afterlife. And in that week, we will work on creating a short film of your memory that you can then screen and then bring with you, and everything else is left behind. And it's this astonishing way of looking at cinema as memory and looking at memory as self and thinking about what it is that you do and what you really think and what is important, like the one moment of your life that you could take, you know. And it really, every time I watch it, I just find myself hunting for that moment for myself. You know, it's astonishing film. We always do a huge horror series. My big one I'm excited about this year is called The Innocence of Children, and it's all about killer kids. And so we're doing The Omen, and we're doing It's Alive, and we're doing, you know, like The Innocence and The Haunting, and as many as we can do, really. So I'm very excited about that. And then in November, we're doing a big Robert Bresson series, and Ohazar Belthazar is a really famous one, but we're doing some of his other ones too. And he's kind of like a European auteur that's sort of a must-see in cinema, and most of it's on 35, so I'm pretty excited about that. Yeah, I think the fall calendar is very exciting. If you go to trilon.org, you can see everything that's coming up through November. We've got it all up there now, so... you know, come check out Repertory Cinema. There, here at the Heights, there's lots of cool stuff happening around town. And I think the more that Minneapolis can embrace the small sense and these old films that deserve another look, I think the more vibrant they become. And the more that people come, the more freedom we have to do the stuff that's really hard and really weird to see. Independent cinema is strong and healthy. It's right now, I think new cinema is just fine. And I think most of it seems to be controlled by the bigger studios, but there's still interesting films being made. And that stuff is available all over the place on Netflix or Amazon or whatever. As far as repertory cinema, it's getting trickier. You know, I think video stores are gone, and Amazon has a somewhat varied sense of movies you can rent. But the Amazon Prime stuff, there's not much classic on there at all. Netflix has an atrocious classics collection on it. I think anything that's older than 10 years is considered extremely old to people. And I think the thing that struck me not that long ago was how precious the Trilon is to me is that there's not that many repertory cinemas in the country and even in the world. You know, there's the Metrograph and the Quad and Film Forum in New York City, and they're kind of the hub for repertory cinema. And there's plenty of smaller repertory stuff around the country, and then there's, you know, the New Beverly and UCLA and stuff in LA, and then the Hollywood up in Portland. And other than that, I think it's pretty rare to be able to see old films the way they were presented. People occasionally will do things, or like once a week or once a month. To be an actual full-time repertory cinema is really rare. And if you don't live somewhere near it, you know, to create that for yourself, I think, is buying a lot of Blu-rays. You know, like you get online and you go find this stuff and project it in your backyard or in your basement.
That's all this week here at Real College Podcast. Big thanks to Liv and Ben for their reporting on Eau Claire, and thanks to the Trilon Cinema for taking the time to talk with me. Real College Podcast is a production of Radio K. It is produced by Liv Regan, Ben Hallam, Nathan Fervoy, and as of this week, it is now also being produced by Lizzie Ritchie, who is now our new music reporter. Alex Schumacher, me, is RCP's host and managing editor. All episodes of Real College Podcast can be found online at RadioK.org or on Apple Podcasts. Thanks for listening, and talk to you next week. We'll be right back.